Hi, everybody. Peace. Peace, everybody. Gosh, I still haven't trained people into call and response. I didn't prepare anything, really, and I'm quite tired, and there's a reason. So I guess that's what I'm going to talk about a bit. I'm glad that Chris was talking a bit about prison abolition in his influences and in what he was speaking about, because that's, I guess, mostly what I'm going to speak about. And I also like that he talked about crisis organizing, because I think the realities of doing work with prisoners, and I'm not saying in prisons, I'm saying with prisoners, and I would make a difference there, is that you're always by nature forced into a state of crisis. So last night I had my book launch, which was nice and everything, and at the same time I got a call, and this young man who I've been very connected to goes, you know, I'm getting moved tomorrow. I was supposed to be here till the 30th, but the jail's overcrowded and they're moving me out. This is my last call. I'm not going to have calls. I don't know when I'm getting calls. And that's it. That's the end, right? And that's what the system does. They don't, you know, it's not like when somebody gets sentenced that they call you into a room with the family and they say, you know, this is what to expect. You know, this is how many days you have. This is what's going to happen. It doesn't work that way, right? When they feel like when the pen run's happening, that's what happens. You got to leave your shit in your cell. They'll ship it to you later. So, you know, Aiden brought his stuff to court, like all his poetry, because he didn't know if he'd be able to see it again, right? So he, like, literally bought in a big garbage bag when he went to get sentenced. And his lawyer's like, wow, you generate more paper than my entire office, you know? But he literally came to court with a garbage bag of poetry, because if you don't bring it with you then and get it to your dad, when they toss your cell, they'll chuck it, you know? So that's 3 years, 2.5 years of work. So you just don't know. And that means families don't know. Nobody's ever going to sit with you in the system and say, you know, here's how you get phone calls to Spring Hill. You know, here's what the day looks like in reception. This is when you can expect to put in canteen. You find it out from other inmates. So basically, the inmates are the conduit for information and also for support. So as much as people kind of, and I mean legitimate fears about prison, one of the least helpful things people said to me recently is he good looking? Are you scared of him getting raped? I'm like, no, I really wasn't there with my list of fears. I was thinking more beating up, but thanks for giving me that list of fears about Renus. But at the same time as we have, you know, like, obviously ideas about violent inmates and fears about people in prison, there's immense support networks that come from inmates within prison. They're the ones that have to handle each other, which can also be the source of problems, right? Like when people, you know, you get into debt with people and then there's problems. But, you know, the only information, legal information coming out of inmates, Nova Scotia has, like, the worst legal aid in Canada. I think it's, like, the second worst. So, you know, lawyers just simply often don't have the time and the resources to give the kind of service that they would want, even if they're dedicated, and not everybody is. You know, so your lawyer doesn't have the time to sit with you and say, this is what you're going to expect, you know, like, this is what's going to happen. They don't know because the correctional system is completely separated from the legal system. And what happens inside CSC, which is federal, is different from what happens inside provincial jail. Your lawyer probably doesn't handle any of that business, so they don't really know. The minute you get into corrections, it's all through CSC. Different provinces, different services. So it's the only people that can give you that advice in terms of this is your appeals. It's people who've been through the system. So the inmates are this tremendous source of solidarity for each other and for families. And I guess that's what I wanted to talk about, because one of the challenges, I think, of activism, and there's always this sense that there's a barrier between us and what we do. And Sherry will know this as well. I mean, we're in our communities, and there's a difference between, I guess, entering into a community and organizing within and the kind of activism we do outside communities. Because the kind that we do outside when we're coming in and we're organizing something, you can walk away from that. There's an end point. And I think that there's this feeling that that's what you really want to do, is do enough to be active but don't get involved. And I think you particularly see that with prison activism, where I think a lot of people are acutely aware that this is a serious issue. It might be the issue of the 21st century, you know. What are we going to do up about our prisons? So I think there's increasing awareness of prisons as a structural, as an economic, you know, the relation to capitalism. You know, you've seen great theoretical work done, conversations that are happening that, you know, you didn't even see happening 5-10 years ago. But at the same time, I think there's this sense of work with but don't go in. And I think when you go in, there's a whole different set of problems, because when you have to go in and say to yourself, well, if I want to relate, you know, then you have to have relationships with people, and then you enter into being in the situation of now being a loved one or a family member within the prison, which is a totally different thing from being an activist, because activists can leave, right? Families don't have a choice. There is no choice in the prison system, so you just have to figure it out and deal with it, right? But you can't exit it. So to a certain extent, what I'm saying is there is no activism in terms of having a relationship with prisoners because there's no options, right? You can't do activism with the guards because they don't have to send your mail. And I used to send in I got our prisons obsolete into the prison, and then they changed the regulations on the mail. So that's jail. They don't have to let in what they don't want to let in. They can just put it in your personals, right? They don't have to let you ride if they don't want to. They don't have to let you visit if they don't want to. Especially when you're federal, there's decent visiting, but you get reviewed. So if they have any reason to not want you, they don't have to let you in. And they don't have to justify that. You could take things to court, and a lot of inmates go through injustices and they want to take it to court. But by the time you get out and it's like 5 years, if you can find a lawyer, do you really want to spend your life pursuing that injustice, or do you want to get on with their life? Well, everyone wants to get on with their life, plus fears about your parole. So nobody really pursues these, and people who aren't in it don't see it. So there's no real activism. There's like, keep your head down, do your time, and get the hell out, right? So if you're actually in the position of being family and being in relationship with people, you're no longer, in a sense, active, but at the same time, you're doing the work that needs to be done, which is, I think, overwhelmingly the emotional work, the supportive work. We know that in our prisons and jails, federal's a bit better. Burnside, which I talk a lot about, there's no social services, there's no psychiatric services. Obviously, a lot of people that are in have addictions. Many of them have put their families through hell because that's what happens when you have addictions. People have stolen from their families, been violent with their families. So a lot of people in there and their families do not communicate with them, so they're just completely alone. So we do a radio show. Not anymore, because they cut the number. This is my point. We used to, until 2 weeks ago, we did a radio show where the inmates could call in. And because they hear you on the radio, like, a lot of them would want to call and just be like, my family doesn't talk to me. What am I going to do when I get out? And they want a voice. And because they're hearing voices, CKDU gets a lot of this, actually, like a lot of inmate mail. Because they're hearing your voice on the radio, they actually kind of latch on. They need that support. They call, do you know what, and it's not just legal, it can be stuff like, do you know a lawyer, or, I want to make a complaint about my mental health treatment. Sometimes it's just like, a lot of guys ask me if I have any girls, like friends that they can get with, I feel like if I had a girlfriend, I'd have a reason to keep living, will somebody love me is really the question they're asking, can I go through this experience, can I have this record? Can I, be this kind of person I've been told I am and get out on the other end and maybe start a family? Can I have the love that I want, which is really what they're asking you. So a lot of guys get on the phone and say, do you have any friends like you? I was walking from the English department having this conversation with a guy, and then I was like, well, do you have any convictions for domestic assault? And I think my department head thought I was trying to date somebody. And he was looking at me like, are you crazy? But it's simple, is what I'm saying, right? That we have this level of dialogue where we talk very much about, and they're real issues. That is the issue, right? Who's building the prisons? Where are the contracts? I could go on forever and ever about this. I got an argument with a guard last night on Facebook about the whole systems of the prison. Why is Telmate, which is an American phone corporation, and they also do the canteen, why are they in our prisons in Nova Scotia? This is based in Colorado. They service hundreds and hundreds of institutions. And they've been recently brought into Nova Scotia prisons. Why? Who signed that contract? Who gets the kickbacks? Telmate, for example, for $10 of phone calls, you have to pay $16. So $6 in service fees. For people on fixed incomes, obviously these kinds of things, $20 of canteen, they take off three. Canteen, so a bottle of pop that would be 59 cents at Walmart. And they actually say not for resale. They're sold for $2. So, a pad of paper, a little shitty pad of paper is $2. Everything's hiked. It's hiked up. They can have shortages whenever they want. This is all going in through an American corporation. There's been no transparency. Nobody's asked the government, who's signing these contracts. We don't know anything about this. And, thousands of our brothers and sisters and cousins and husbands or whatever, sisters, wives are, at the mercy of these contracts, and we don't know anything about them. So, obviously there's a huge financial issue. We know that people in our prisons, Nova Scotia has the second longest wait time in jail. So people are waiting 2 years and more. It's dangerously close now for people in terms of having to have their cases thrown out because they're coming so close to not having a speedy trial. But people are waiting 2 years for trials. So we know there's all these systematic issues. Legal aid chronically underfunded in Nova Scotia. So the kind of services that are available. Manitoba, where my sister works as a lawyer, actually has the best legal aid. So like 90% of what they do is covered, Nova Scotia doesn't. So when you don't cover legal aid, it means that you're not serving the people who actually need justice, right? The poor communities, the marginalized communities. So these are all systematic issues, and I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about them. I talk about them all the time. Burnside, you know, they just had a story about shit bombs, like people shit bombing the guards. And of course, everyone was more like, these animals on the ranges, you know, like, what are they doing? Well, Burnside has chronic problems because Burnside has a capacity of 229 and they're over 400 right now. So everybody's double bunked. And their response is to increase the discipline. So the guards are stressed, the guards are frustrated. The frontline workers, they've removed all programs. There's no social workers. There used to be chapel four times a day on Sunday. They stripped it out. People liked to go because it was live music. That's why people went down, whether or not they were religious. AA meetings, there's been one in a year. And they didn't even have donuts and coffee, and that's why everyone goes to the AA meetings, is for the donuts and coffees, and they didn't have that. You know, psychiatric, like I said, there's no staff psychiatrist at Burnside, and people are waiting 2 years, you know, so there's no traumatic counseling for people who have been through traumatic events. And yes, perpetrators have been through traumatic events as well. It is a traumatic event to have assaulted somebody or to, you know, and I know, oh, well, don't sympathize with the criminal, but I mean, how do we expect people to work out their issues if we don't give them some kind of counseling to work it out? You know, what happens when you spend over 2 years with only yourself to sound out your issues and you can't even talk about it to other people on the phone because they're going to, if your friends or family have any sense, they're going to tell you these calls are monitored, don't say anything, right? So you don't even have an outlet for speaking about what's happened to you, processing. You certainly can't talk about your fears because that gets back to parole. So you can't say, you know, I'm scared this person's going to kill me because then you're going to get, it's a problem. Like then you've listed someone as incompatible and you're a snitch and you're going to have problems with PC. So I mean, people have to handle all these things themselves and there's no counseling, you know, there's no psychiatrist on staff. There's medical staff once a week. If you want an x-ray or something, it can be like up to 2 weeks. One of the young men in the prison on Father's Day, his dad called him. Well, he called his dad, and his dad said, I love you. And that was like the first time. His dad was extremely abusive to him, and he couldn't handle that emotionally, so he hung up the phone and he put his hand through the phone. And he broke like all the bone, like, you know, three or four bones in his hand. The bones were sticking out of his hand. And I happened to be talking to somebody else at the time. And he's like, oh, you know, this guy just like punched the phone. And I kind of got him on the phone and was like, are you okay? Like, what are you doing kind of thing? And I had to basically counsel him. I'm not a trained counselor. And it took him 2 weeks to get in to get an x-ray. You know, like this bone, he had a compound fracture, you know? I mean, his hand's not going to be the same. Like, so that's a medical issue. It also shows you the kind of issues, emotional issues that people are dealing with. And like I said, a lot of people are abandoned by their families, you know, for, I'm not blaming the families, like they may have good reason, right? Like dealing with people with addictions and mental illness is not easy. And obviously a lot of people in prison are struggling with those issues. So this is all a long way of saying that yes, you know, yes, there are political issues. Yes, we need to talk about prisons and capitalism. You know, yes, we need to talk about race and the justice system. Obviously, we have to talk about all those things. But I think there's also areas of activism where we as activists tend to hold ourselves aloof and say, as long as I'm doing this academically, it's okay. As long as I'm studying, that's okay. As long as this is my work, that's okay. But don't love anybody. You know, don't get up in people's shit because that's unhealthy, right? So then people start going like, chill out, like you need to back off, right? Because there's a sense of like, we can't do this. You know, we need to preserve ourselves. And I'm saying that I think that's something we need to look at. That where is our activism? Where's our emotional involvement? You know, is it work? Is it study? Is it, you know, classes that we teach? Is it our resume? I mean, I'm a poet. A lot of artists are big into this right now. We always have activist panels. And like, as long as you went to like one school, you're an activist, right? So I'm such, and then people label themselves activists. And I'm like, I thought activist was a label given to you by people. You know, maybe that's just me. But, you know, there's a glamour in activism, right? Everybody wants to be an activist in some sense. This is a corporate appropriation of the notion of activism because that's okay if we're activists, you know. I just read a great article on Black Agenda Report that was going in on like the Ice Bucket Challenge, but it was talking about like America and the white plantation and basically saying that charity is a way that we maintain our affection for the white supremacist plantation. It's a good article, you should check it out. But I mean, there's a real co-optation of our energies as well, of activist energies. And that's all well and good as long as you don't get involved, you know? It's not supposed to be your being. It's not supposed to be, you're not supposed to cry over people. You're not supposed to give them money, you know? Like, that's too much, you know? Don't have people up on your shit. Don't have them in your phone calls. And I'm saying that when we speak about prison abolition in particular, I think we need to have that conversation, right? Like, what do people need? And I would say, from what I've seen, you know, people first and foremost need love. And that sounds stupid. You know, oh, no. Did I just listen to her talk for 12 minutes ago? Love is the answer. That's not what I'm saying, because I'm talking about radical love. But I'm saying that we don't always talk exactly for that reason, because it's like cringe-inducing to talk about love and activism. And we try to keep our radical thought intellectual and rational, because it needs to be, right? We need to talk strategy. We need to talk structure. It can't all just be kisses and hugs in the fields. You know, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about building movements. But I think that conversation about what radical love looks like, what radical involvement looks like when it's involvement, when it's emotional involvement and not just intellectual involvement, when it's not work, you know, when it's being, when what does it mean to, you know, make a commitment to witnessing in particular ways, meaning you can't walk away, right? Meaning saying, well, I don't have the right to step out, you know, no matter how tired I am, I have to stay with this, because they have to stay with it, because guess what? They don't have a choice. You know, so I think those are important questions. And I think that especially when we're talking about the abolition of something as endemic as prisons and as, you know, inextricable as prisons, you know, to remember the people inside them, that they are people inside them, you know, which is the fundamental question, that these are human beings inside them. And then we have to keep in mind they have human needs. So I guess I want to say that. I had one more thing I wanted to say, and now I forgot. I thought of it as I was talking, and then I forgot it. Oh, I was just going to say a bit about the radio show, because, you know, like, I suppose on a positive note, but also on an illustrative note. So I mentioned that we did this radio show, and I want to speak about that, because it shows, I think, radical possibilities within both, well, within incarcerated communities, and it shows that there is such a thing as an incarcerated community. So this young man, Aiden, he reached out to me through poetry, so we had like a poetry relationship. He wanted criticism and stuff. And then he ended up, like, we have this radio show, Youth Now Radio. It's at 5:30 p.m. on Mondays at CKDU. And, you know, he started calling in because he wanted to read his work. And then he would call other people to the phone, right, because people want to communicate, especially a lot of people don't have their phones hooked up. Like I said, they don't necessarily have family. So people wanted to come to the phone, and very basic, you know, I want to shout out my mom, I want to shout out my little brother if they're listening. And they probably weren't listening, but that act of speaking into something and speaking towards somebody was meaningful. So then some of those people started writing poems. So it was like between people on the range, you know, so it would be like, oh, I'll lock up with you, and can you try and help me write a poem? So people would write poems. Some of it was like, you know, mom, I'm sorry for my addiction type poetry. And some of it was like write hard kind of stuff. There was one guy who, you know, did this poem. We were like just cringing because, like, and we had the mics off and we were like laughing because it was so like, because, you know, it got worse and worse. Like it was started like, I am the crack cooker. And we're like, okay. And then it was like, you know, there was guns involved. And we're like, all right. And then there were people buried under sheds. And we were like, holy crap. And then, you know, it goes on for like 5 minutes. And we're like, oh my God, covered in blood. Like, what's happening? But, you know, you just like roll with it. So we're like, okay, you know, so how do you feel about that? Like, you know, why are you telling us about this? And you talk to them. And then, you know, the next week he came back and he read a poem about his little brother and why he didn't want to keep returning to prison because his little brother looks up to him as a father and he never had a father. So being able to speak about it and have a conversation about it in that short time, it actually allowed him to sort of work through and a lot of those kind of masculinity issues that exist within the prison and then be able to do something that was heartfelt and vulnerable. There's another woman who used to call in and she was like hard, like we're like, yo, you are too raw. Like she would be talking about, like, you know, like, so-and-so's a snitch, like, naming them, like, in the show, and, you know, this guard by this name is a bitch, and you're like, oh, shit, you know, and again, we're like, you know, you're really talented, but, you know, you need to chill out, like, you're gonna get us in trouble, and then again, because she had been given an outlet, she came back with a really beautiful poem where she went through everyone in the prison who braids the hair the best, you know, who's the best to listen to, who tells the best stories, and it was, like, a really beautiful poem about community within the prison. And then a lot of people use the opportunity for self-reflection. You know, they talk about where they are in their lives, what's happened to them. And outside of the kind of prison programming, because, like, prison gives you this programming, but it's always about accountability. If you've ever met anyone who's been incarcerated, they'll all tell you the same thing. I put myself here by my actions. That exact phrase is what you'll hear 100% because that's what they teach you in the prison accountability programs. They have stuff like not minimizing your crime and you're not allowed to say, like, well, I dealt drugs because I was poor and I'm from a racialized, marginalized community. You can't say that. That's minimizing your crime. So you basically have to be like, yeah, I didn't want to get a job. So, I mean, there's a certain dialogue that counts as accountability in prison. And when you remove that official dialogue, you actually see people engaging with their own processes of self-reflection, which are probably coming to the same place that the prison wants to get you to, which is like, I need to stop coming back in here. But through genuine processes of accountability, there is accountability. People do hold themselves accountable. You know, the sense that we need to hold prisoners accountable and that punishment is the way we do that. No, people are holding themselves accountable in all kinds of ways. You know, people are intimately acquainted with their shortcomings and what they want to do about them and what structures they can find. So this was happening on the range, and then the other ranges were tuning in and being able to hear people like them, you know, that were doing this work. So people would call in and they'd be like, well, if he's the poet laureate, I'm the rap laureate, and I'm going to rap for you, you know? And we ended up with about like 12 to 18 calls, depending on the day, of people doing like poetry, or sometimes they just wanted to call in for music. And there was like communication across the ranges. People like North versus West, and West is PC, and usually PC, like, people think they're rats or sex offenders. So a lot of people don't really, like, you're basically under an obligation if you see someone PC to beat them down. But because it was like the radio, people would be like, shout out to this person on that range. It might be a PC range. So they were actually kind of getting rid of these hierarchies that get imposed within the prison. And I'm not painting this like one, like, yay, it's not, I'm not saying some Orange is New Black shit. Like, you know, prison is like just this, ooh, it's really just like a dormitory. I'm not saying a prison is a revolutionary space. There's all kinds of shit that goes down on the range. You won't talk on the phone without people screaming. There's fights every day. I'm not, and that's because of the system, not because of the people. So I'm not saying it's this ideal space, but I'm saying that people build radical solidarity with each other. And we saw it happening in the radio show, and then somebody did an illegal shout out and we got cut off. So if anybody knows anyone high up in the Department of Justice, holler at me. But I guess I wanted to talk about that because, I mean, one, obviously it shows, you know, the powers of radical art and self-generated radical art. I had this great conversation with Aiden where he was like really frustrated. And he's like, oh, I'm so mad at this person. I'm like, why? He's like, man, he came into my cell. And, you know, he's like, starts reading me this poem. And the end poem, end line, he's talking about somebody like buried, like somebody's body buried. I tell a lot about, there's a lot of poems about people buried in a shed. And he's like, you know, he's talking about people buried in a shed. So I said to him, what's this line here? And I'm like, this is the most amazing conversation I've ever heard. And the guy goes, well, he's like, well, has that happened to you? And the guy's like, well, no. He's like, well, then why are you writing about it? And he's like, well, it happens to people. He's like, well, what people? Who does it happen to? You should write things that are real, you know? And this was like a conversation coming from a young man to another young man. And they were like engaging through literature with authenticity and what was real. And he's like, no, like, why don't you go back and write something about you? Like, why don't you write what happened to you? You know, and this is like the kind of argument that they were having. And he's like, and then he threw his poem in the garbage. So I picked it up and I put it back on his bed and he ripped it up. And I'm like, man, you guys are having a poetry fight like inside the prison? Like, but it was amazing. You know, it was an amazing conversation. It was like not by two academics or, you know, people that were on a panel. It was, you know, two guys, grade 9, 10 education, no literary training, who had, you know, through their self-generated processes of critique and reflection, were coming to these understandings of what it means to be honest, what it means to be true to yourself, what it means to hold yourself accountable. So it is possible. That's what I'm saying. It's possible. Even in, you know, the worst circumstances, you know, people who have been just treated like garbage by society, people with all challenges, you know, the least free situation, you know, and there's, let's get rid of any bullshit of, you know, oh, you can free your mind in prison because you can't, you know, well, you can, but then they can take your pen and paper from you, you know, so, like, I'm not idealistic about these things, like, as you see, they can cut off the number, that's what they can do, it's jail, but I think within that, I've seen and I've participated in what is a radical community of people because people showing solidarity and love against those odds is radical. And then my sort of call is that we cannot be scared of that as activists. You know, we cannot hold ourselves different from that. We have to enter into that. And I think when we're entering into that, it's rough on us. You know, it's high burnout. But I think that concept of radical love has to be at the center of all the organizing we're doing. So I'm going to stop there because I know I'm going over time. Thank you.